Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about some networking topics. So we went over DNS and caching in DNS. So DNS, we mentioned, we distributed this database of all these mappings from names to IP addresses everywhere. And to make this viable, we wanted especially these servers that were responsible for knowing kind of the root information, the information for COM, EDU, UK, all these sort of top level things. We didn't want those to be queried every time because, you know, even though there are a lot of them, if there's not that many of them, they can't actually handle all that sort of requests. So we can do caching where we can remember what they return and other DNS servers return. And the way that's done is that servers give this time to live, which says this information, you can cache it for this long. And they kind of give up getting sort of queried for updates on that information for that amount of time. Now you mentioned some things we had to do to make our layers behave together. So we were missing some things with respect to sort of the gap between our link layer setup and our network layer setup. So our link layers use these MAC addresses, which were assigned to hardware. So the MAC addresses were kind of fixed, always set up. But the problem is that if we're using MAC addresses to send things on our Wi-Fi or on our local wired network, well, that's not how we're actually sending things in like our web browsers. We're using IP addresses. So we need to meet that gap. And the kind of the basic technique that ends up being used for that is basically we have a way of asking everyone on our network a question, and that question is, who has this IP address that I expect to be on this network? We also need to set up IP addresses, and our primary mechanism for doing that was something like DHCP. There's actually a different thing we didn't talk about for IPv6, but the basic idea that's in all these kind of auto configuration systems is our machine asks on the network, so, hey, I'd like an address, and there's something the system administrator set up on the network that gives an address, and also the other network configuration information. For example, you know, if you want to get stuff out of this network, where do you send it to first, and things like that. Then we dealt with kind of a pesky reality issue. So I talked about networks where everyone had their own address, and we just put the address in our messages, and that uniquely identified the machine it goes to. And because the people designing IP version 4 made an unfortunate mistake of only allowing for 4 billion addresses, and maybe like several hundred million of those are actually not usable, we are kind of low on IP version 4 addresses, and IP version 4 is usually what we use. So we have to have a way of having multiple devices use one IP version 4 address on the real internet. And our solution for that is they use these private local addresses, and we have some router or something like that map them to a smaller number of public addresses, so we use less addresses. But to have them share these public addresses, we need to kind of divide up the port numbers. And so we just have a table saying, if it comes from this IP address in this port, what machine does it go to in the private IP addresses that aren't visible externally? And the router does this extra translation that normally wouldn't be part of routing, but has to be to do this sort of IP address to IP address mapping scheme. So questions on the networking topics covered last time? So we also started covering security, which will be our main topic for today and probably the first part of Thursday. And we talked about sort of the two security goals we're going to deal with, which were confidentiality. We want to keep private information in the hands of only the people who are supposed to have it and not let other people learn it. And the most notable case for why other people would learn it is that we're sending things across the internet. It has to go through these routers, who we don't want to have to trust with all that information. And we also care about authenticity, that if I'm sending something across the internet, I want the party I'm sending it to know where it comes from, even though it actually went through these routers that we, again, don't trust. And we have these two mathematical tools we figured out we could use to build this confidentiality and authenticity with some setup that was a problem, but we'll deal with later. And those two tools were encryption and message authentication codes. So with encryption, we got this function I called E that takes a key and some data and produces a ciphertext. And then there's a corresponding invert function that takes the ciphertext and the key and produces back the original data. The data, I guess, as was noted on the slides, this is sometimes called the plain text. And the people designing our encryption functions are going to somehow ensure that, assuming we choose a key that is not practical to guess, which we basically do by just choosing something that's random and long enough, then it's not possible to do anything useful with the ciphertext without the key, even if you know the function E. Like, that's not going to help. And yet, running this D function to kind of invert the process with the key is going to be practical and fast. So that gives us confidentiality, assuming we have the setup step where we somehow make sure everyone has the keys who's supposed to have the data, and no one who is not supposed to have the data has the keys. We also have a primitive for doing authenticity with a similar setup where we have this key that we've shared in advance somehow with this thing we call the message authentication code, where we take a key and some data and we get what we call a tag. And the idea is that the only way of getting the correct tag for some data is having the key. And even if you know, for example, know the key for some data, if you change that data a little bit, you don't have any way of figuring out the tag unless you also figure out the key. And we can kind of think of this as kind of like a sort of keyed checksum or a keyed hash function. So it acts like a checksum, but you need a key to compute the checksum in any useful way. Yes?
Does that mean that the data changes the key that's used with the data in the map function? Does the key also change?
Question, does the key change when we change the data? No. So the idea is we fix the key in advance, and we could use this multiple times on different data, potentially. There are some questions about, is that really safe, which we'll get to later today. And there's going to be a different solution to make it actually safe. If you're thinking of, gosh, isn't that a problem? You're right to think there might be a problem. Other questions? Okay, so when I glanced over the quiz results, there is probably the most confusion on the quiz over confidentiality and message authentication code. So we had a scenario on the quiz where, in question 5, where we had an attacker who could recompute the message authentication code. And we asked how that dealt with confidentiality. And a problem we have is that when we were writing that question, if you looked at what we were doing, we did Mac key C knew, C key the attacker knew, knows, and data that the attacker is not supposed to know. And the problem here is that if the attacker can make a list of the possible values of data, and that list isn't too big, they can just check all of them. So, for example, let's say our possible messages are yes and no, is our possible data, we can just check what's the tag for yes, what's the tag for no, and there we've learned the data. if there are more possible messages, we could say, oh, you know, there's a receipt with a price, there are 100,000 possible prices. That's practical to check. Unlike guessing all the keys, which there's going to be more than 100,000 possible to check. Yes? Quick question, couldn't the data be anything? So wouldn't it be the same entropy as the key itself? So we didn't specify what the data it was, but in sort of any realistic scenario, like the data is meaningful, you know, in some has some real world meaning, and that's going to let our attacker make guesses about it. And at the least, the attacker can eliminate some of those guesses at a minimum with by checking the tags. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Are we assuming the MAC is a public function that everyone knows? Yes. All the functions I'm showing, the encrypt and decrypt function, the MAC function, and all the functions we'll show today, we're assuming everyone knows the functions. And if we want something to not be known to an attacker, we're going to have one of the parameters to the function, usually something we'll call a key, not be known to the attacker. But we assume the attacker is going to get to know the function. And kind of the logic for this is that keeping the function secret, we can kind of transform that into having a more generic function that takes the secret part as a parameter. And so just imagine we've done that if you like to keep the function secret. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, the attacker can eliminate some possible explanations for the data, but is that an efficient algorithm? So it depends what the sort of format of the data is. And we didn't specify it. So indeed, if what A and B are sending to each other is a random number, yeah, that's not useful. But that is almost never what we're doing, right? We're almost never just sending a random number. So for any kind of realistic scenario, the kind of space of plausible messages is usually a lot smaller. And the attacker will usually be able to get something useful out of it. In the question, we asked for information, like we weren't explicit about how much, I guess, but you know, even if in realistic scenarios, like most of the time, like the attacker has some information, has a lot of information about what the data is likely to look like, right? Just based on the context. Like if it's a payment system, we know what payment requests look like. If it's a website login, we probably can log into the website ourselves and know what that looks like and so on. Does that answer your question? Seems like an ill. I indeed did not very formally define things, and that's yes, I agree. What I was aiming for is like that, in that scheme, like the message authentication code, like doesn't really help us keep the data secret if the attacker knows the key to it. Message authentication code doesn't keep the data that you pass to it secure. Like that is not a property the message authentication code had if you know the key. And I guess we didn't talk about how message authentication codes work, but you know, that's, you know, you shouldn't assume it works that way. You need to use encryption if you need that, want that guarantee. That's not reversible. Is that, yeah. But I understand, I didn't like try to define things very precisely, which is maybe a bad trade-off I'm making to not like make this a proofs about cryptography class, which is indeed how you're supposed to do this stuff. Other questions? Yeah.
How does the attacker end up knowing the information about the format of the data?
About the format of the data? So the question is how is this used, right? And usually there's some context, like if it's a payment system, we can probably look up what payments look like in the payment system, even though we're not supposed to know what the specific payments are. Like, if it's a website that you log into, you can log into the website yourself and know what the messages sent as part of that login process look like, even if you don't know the specific values. And usually when we're talking about cryptography, we try to avoid making assumptions about the attacker not knowing sort of most of the message, except very small parts of it. Because in practice, that's really hard to keep secret. You generally can't assume that that's secret, and we design our cryptography to survive that not being secret, because in practice, it's kind of a fool's errand to say, no one's gonna know what our messages look like. They probably are gonna, have ways of figuring it out in practice. And we want the mathematical schemes to not care about that. Other questions? Okay, and briefly mentioning some anonymous feedback, saying we have very good TAs. I'm glad I found good TAs. I hope to do that in the future. Oh, sorry, question first. Can I go over question one?
So specifically this wire network step?
Yeah.
What is the difference between, why do packets contain frames when my understanding was that frames contain packets?
So frames do contain packets. So what we're doing is we have A here to A's router to B's router to B. And here we're going to send a frame that contains the packet. And then we're going to send another frame that contains a packet from A's router to B's router. And we're going to send a third frame that contains the packet from A's router to B's router going forward. And the acknowledgement's going to be another packet where we do this in reverse. And I've drawn three different frames here. They all contain the same packet internally, but the frame itself is different because it has to have different sources and destinations, each of those frames.
Other than this, do all network layers involve frames, or do they have different names for their types of frames?
Question, do all network layers involve frames? If we're using the link layer, the link layer uses frames, and if we want to send things on a local network, we need to have frames somewhere. So, yes. There's types of networks which don't send, have a connection in a physical way, but we haven't talked about this. But ignoring those things that aren't the internet, yeah, they always involve frames. Yeah. Can I go over six? So I believe six. Oh, I wrote the wrong thing here, didn't I? I guess I wrote part of the right thing. So in B, we can confirm guesses with the MAC, plus we can, compute a new MAC if we know how we're changing, how we're corrupting the encrypted data.
How do we know how we're corrupting?
So it depends on the encryption algorithm, but often we can flip something in the cipher, flip a bit in the ciphertext, and know what that does to the plaintext. And know that that flips a bit in the plaintext, and we mentioned that example. Okay. Or we can otherwise have, educated information, or we can truncate the message and know that truncates the plaintext. So there's some types of manipulation we can do which tend to be predictable. Question there, or?
For four, what's actually done in practice?
What's actually done in practice for four? So So four was asking about, we want to share, have an IP be shared on all systems, right? Was the idea, we want to have an IP like moves around as we move around. The question is, how do we achieve that? So if we're talking about something like the UVA Wi-Fi, the UVA Wi-Fi appears generally as one, as a relatively large single wireless network that's actually implemented with kind of multiple subnetworks. And there's some logic to like direct the traffic to the right subnetwork, but look like a big wireless network. So there's no chain. So it sort of looks like that solution, but it's like over just to, you know, deciding what part of the wireless network, big wireless network to use. If you want to move between different networks, this is the kind of solution you need. And most people just change IP addresses instead. Is that the most practical solution is to have something forward the messages to you, basically, from where they would normally go. Yeah?
If you can compute the new ciphertext of a different message without knowing the key, is that by definition not a security key?
Question, if I can compute a new ciphertext without knowing the key, is that secure encryption? So the reason that the attacker could do that is they knew what the data was. So encryption functions are not designed to resist us manipulating the encrypted message, if we know manipulating the encrypted message in any way. So if we know what the encrypted message is supposed, you know, what the plain text is, we can make new ciphertexts that are potentially meaningful based on that. How do we know which data the ciphertext corresponds to? So in the example, so we can make an educated guess, and if we're wrong, we fail, but the assumption in the question was the attacker could guess. If in B, the attacker could confirm their guess with a MAC, so they could be sure about what the data was.
But you can't do
You can't do that efficiently. So what do we know about the data being sent, right?
Yeah.
So, and that depends on how the data is produced, which depends on the scenario, right? If the data is a random number, obviously we don't. In many real scenarios, we might be able to know the full data, right? So you're giving the example of a payment system. I might know how much is supposed to be paid to who at what time. That is something that's would be a common scenario for an attacker to be able to figure out.
But can you get a MAC from an encryption algorithm?
Can you get a MAC from an encryption algorithm?
Right.
In cryptography? What do you mean from an encryption algorithm?
But given the existence of an encryption algorithm, you can construct a MAC.
So the question is, you've learned in cryptography that you can construct MACs from encryption algorithms. So what I'm calling an encryption algorithm in this class is not the lower level primitives that are used to build encryption algorithms. So for example, AES is a, sometimes called an encryption algorithm, is a block cipher. And what it does is, given a key, it converts a 128-bit number to another 128-bit number in a sort of, in a way that's a permutation. So there's a unique one-to-one mapping in each direction. And indeed, there's a way to construct secure encryption from that, which would be one of these encryption functions where I haven't actually specified how long the data is and things like that, and to construct MACs from that. But there's some extra steps, and those extra steps really matter. So, they're not like the same. So like the MAC function you build from that does not look like the encryption function and how it actually works, even though it's built from the same kind of tool of kind of a way of randomizing some data. Does that answer your question?
Not really.
Yeah.
So I've got a question about
OK.
Oh, it's just a packet. Okay.
So I guess going to the like building max functions. So I guess I'm taking the term encryption function. Like, so encryption functions vary in how easy it is to manipulate the encrypted data, which is, I guess, a point of confusion. In some cases, it's trivial. In some cases, it's a more limited, but usually there's some malleability. Like, most commonly, you can truncate the data, and if the, you need something extra to avoid that, as we've defined encryption functions. So some tools will give you something that combines encryption and a MAC together, which is a great idea, sometimes called authenticated encryption, which is indeed what you should do. And what many tools may provide you, and of course, if you're doing encryption and MAC together with the same key, then you kind of, in a correct way, then you kind of avoid the message being manipulatable. Okay, and on anonymous feedback, some feedback on the OpenMP lab about the issue of combining the map and reduce strategy not being clear enough. I'll think about how to change that for future semesters. My hope was the examples in the reduce section would help with that, but I guess they're not too far into the lab and or like it's too hard to make them generic and actually readable. Okay. So we talked about doing cryptography, getting confidentiality from our encryption tool, and getting authenticity from this message authentication code tool. But this relies on us sort of setting up these shared secrets in advance. And this means we kind of need secure communication of these secrets, these keys, to do secure communication. And you might quite legitimately argue that, you know, this kind of defeats the purpose, right? If we can send these keys securely, why do we need all this extra stuff? Because we can already send keys securely. And it also has this scaling problem. If we think of the problem of, I want my browser to contact websites securely, there's millions of websites, millions of browsers, billions of browsers. So we need to make trillions of keys. Like, that is not practical. So we're going to have a sort of different set of mathematical tools to make this practical. But we're not going to completely eliminate this kind of problem here, that we're going to need to do secure communication to do secure communication. That we're going to need some setup step that somehow is going to need some secure communication that's not done in a way we have a mathematical tool to fix. And that's kind of inevitable because without this kind of setup step, there's no way to distinguish me from an attacker, right? That I'm the same unless we have some extra information about me versus the attacker, which means I have to have something the attacker can't know. There needs to be some setup. But we'll figure out a way of doing this, which is going to have sort of two nice properties that are going to make it practical. And one is that we're going to have a way of doing the setup where the secure communication can be a broadcast communication. That rather than me and the, you know, my web browser and Google.com sort of sharing a key, Google.com can broadcast a key to everybody. And that's a lot easier to manage logistically. And well, we're also going to deal with the issue of, well, you know, that solves the billions of web browsers problem, kind of, but what about, you know, there's still too many websites and so on. We're going to do this where we only have to have secure communication from a relatively smaller set of what we'll call authorities who are trusted. I'm using the word trusted here. Trusted means that they are relied on to do things. They are trusted. It doesn't mean they're trustworthy. So when I use the word trusted, I mean we're depending on them to do things. That's separate from the question of whether they're actually qualified. Yes?
So the idea is that
There's certain websites where you don't need a key to trust them. So we're going to still need keys, but there's certain websites we're going to trust to do things beyond just run a website. You'll see later, certain authorities, that they aren't websites, but yeah, so there's going to be some organizations who are going to be responsible for doing some work as part of the scheme where we're going to trust them to verify some things for us, and we'll see exactly what that is later. So the basic sort of tool we're going to use in this scheme for confidentiality is going to be something, a variation on encryption we'll call asymmetric encryption. Or sometimes you'll see the term public key encryption. And in this scheme, we're going to have a pair of functions like we did with encryption, an encrypt and a decrypt function, E and D. I'm going to write these as PE and PD. And these functions are not going to take the same key. They're going to take two different keys. The encrypt function is going to take what we'll call a public key, and the decrypt function is going to take a private key. And the idea is that when we generate keys, we aren't just going to choose some random data. We're going to use some process to generate a key pair of a public key and a related private key. And they're going to be related such that these functions actually work. If they aren't related, they obviously, you know, if the private key isn't based on the public key or vice versa, not going to really work. And the idea is that in order to do this decrypt function, you need the private key. And we're not going to share the private key with anyone but people who are supposed to receive this message. So our private key is going to be kept secret by the party who's supposed to receive encrypted messages. And the public key is going to go to everyone. So everyone's going to be able to run this encrypt function. No one is going to be able to sort of decrypt because they won't have the private key except for that one recipient. And generally, sort of mathematically, the public key will be some function of the private key that's hard to reverse. So we'll have these properties that, you know, this public key encryption function, you know, even if we know all the functions, if we don't know the private key, we can't go from a ciphertext back to a message. And this decrypt function will have the property that even if we know, also have the property that even if we know, you know, the ciphertext in a message, or even the ciphertext in a whole bunch of corresponding messages, that's not going to ever help us find the private key. Yeah. We can see all sorts of examples of encrypted messages, generate them, and we'll never learn anything useful about the private key. Okay. So questions on sort of the properties we want to have here? Yeah. Authorities. We will talk more about that later and ask again later if I don't answer it. Other questions? Okay. So we're going to have these very special functions, and other classes will talk about how the functions work. I'll mention sort of as the security that when I talked about the encryption and MAC functions, I said basically doing the, you know, inferring things about the data was kind of as hard as guessing all the possible keys. The way our public key and then our asymmetric encryption functions work, it's not going to be that hard. It's not going to be as hard as try every possible key. And that's just because, you know, we're doing a lot more kind of magic math here, and it's just not going to be as good. But it's still going to be impractical if we choose a large enough key. And that's what we're going to do in practice. And like with asymmetric encryption, we actually want it stronger than these properties I mentioned here, that like we don't want you to be able to like figure out some of the bits of the plain text from the ciphertext or anything like that. And we're going to, you know, do the appropriate math and to make that happen. So I have this way of doing sort of this public and private key encryption. And it turns out that in practice, we're going to kind of combine this with asymmetric, as we'll see later. But you know, I just want to compare and contrast. Yeah, so we have, with asymmetric, we have this one key pair per recipient. So with symmetric, you know, if A was talking to B, we had a key for A and B to share. With this asymmetric encryption, we have one key for A, one key for B, no matter how many people A or B are talking to. We don't have a separate key for each pair, generally. And the private key is never shared with anyone in the asymmetric scheme, whereas in the symmetric scheme, we have to share this key in order to communicate, which is why we're going to usually have multiple keys if we're communicating with multiple parties. And generally, in the asymmetric scheme, we'll be happy to just tell everyone the public key. It's public. And we'll generally assume they know it because it shouldn't matter if they do. And so kind of our use of this, you know, is that let's say we want A to send something to B. So B is going to generate a key pair. It's going to send the public part of it to A in advance somehow. And then A is going to encrypt the message to B, get some ciphertext out, send that ciphertext on the network. B decrypts that and can read the message, but no one else can. Because B has never shared that private key with anyone else. Yes?
So let's say A is a server and it's sending to B1 and B2, like two clients, and they share the same public key.
Question is, if A is sending to two different clients, B1 and B2, could they share the same public key? Not unless they're supposed to be able to read each other's messages. So typically, we would have separate public keys and separate corresponding private keys for B1 and for B2. And A would need to send, you know, if A was sending the same message, A would probably send two copies.
So if the public key and private key are all different, then what is the difference between a symmetric and asymmetric?
What is the difference between symmetric and asymmetric? So here, let's say if there was like a C communicating to B, C could use the same public key again. That would be where we'd get the reuse. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have asymmetric encryption or public key encryption. That's kind of our equivalent of that normal encryption, quote unquote symmetric encryption. We also want an equivalent of message authentication codes for authenticity, and that's going to be something called digital signatures. And digital signatures are going to look a bit different compared to asymmetric encryption. So asymmetric encryption, it kind of looked like encryption, you know, but we just changed the keys. With Max, we had the issue that there's only one function, but clearly we actually want two, one for the secret function, secret person to run, and one for the public version. So we're going to split up our authenticity process into those two functions, which we'll call sign and verify. So we're going to have a sign function that's kind of the closest equivalent to our MAC function, It's just going to produce, well, not something we'll call a tag, but something we'll call a signature. So we're going to take a private key and a message and produce a signature. But of course, we can't give everyone the private key because we don't want people to make signatures for things that they aren't supposed to be able to, because we want to verify the authenticity of messages from some party without to everyone, not just to one person. And we want to have them verify that whoever produced this signature had this private key. That's what our signature is supposed to verify. Whoever produced the signature had the private key and chose to run the S function on that particular message and not something else. And this is going to verify that that message really came from whoever has the private key. For this to make sense, we better not distribute the private key, but that needs to be, we need a way to verify that the signature is correct without the private key. So how do we do that? We're going to have a separate verify function that takes the public key and the signature and the message and either tells us yes or no. And that process is obviously going to have to be more complicated than recomputing the signature because we're not supposed to be able to do that with just the public key. So we have another key pair here. And again, we're going to share the public key with everyone, and we're going to use the private key, but rather than receiving stuff for the private key, we're going to use the private key to send stuff, to send signatures that anyone can verify. Because anyone can have the public key, so they can verify our signatures really correspond to that data and the private key. And anyone who doesn't have the private key can't make a correct signature for any message they choose. They can only reuse signatures that are already out there. So, question on this digital signature. Yes? So the question is, for personal laptops, it's going to be more of the first approach, and for large senders, it's going to be more of the second approach. So you're observing that, you know, if we're communicating with Google, it's easy for Google to distribute their public keys, but it's not easy for your laptop to have done so. So that would be as far as setting, that's a good intuition. What's going to turn out we're going to do in practice is we're going to use these tools to set up actually symmetric encryption and authentication codes. So we're going to do most of our work using that sort of shared secret thing, but this is how we're going to get our sort of shared keys, is using these tools I showed here. Yes?
So are signatures used to verify that the message is actually coming from who you expect it to be coming from?
Question, are signatures used to verify that the message is coming from who you expect it to come from? Yes. So it tells you at least that someone with the private key decided to sign, quote unquote, that message and not some other message. That's all. Other questions? Yes, back there.
So to clarify, private keys are used to receive messages and make signatures.
So private keys are used to receive encrypted messages and to make signatures, yes. So another way I could say is that we have, like, in both asymmetric encryption and signatures, we have a private operation and a public operation. The private operation is decryption or signing. The public operation is encryption or verifying. Other questions? Okay, so our typical example of how we'd use this is, let's say we want to say A wants to tell B how they're paying to make a payment, and we want to make sure that that's not forged. So A will distribute its public key to B, and it will produce a signature on its, you know, message, and send its message and that signature to B. B can recompute, well, so B can use the verify function to verify that that signature actually matches. And any attacker, you know, they can change the please pay message here, but they can't actually make the signature ever pass the verify function if they do that. questions? Okay. So we have these building blocks. So we have these shared secret building blocks and these public key building blocks. And it turns out that these are surprisingly hard to use. And are kind of my main topic for the rest of the day, possibly into Thursday, and also our lab next week, is going to be about sort of some issues that arise when you try to use these building blocks and aren't careful. And we're not going to do the state-of-the-art solution. So if you are making a new thing for web browsers to communicate with web servers, you should actually do actual mathematical proofs, probably using a formal proof system. How you do that is not the scope of this class. It's not, I know about it, I don't do it, but that's sort of the state of the art that people do to verify that they, you know, things are working correctly. What they're trying to prove basically is that, oh, if the attacker can like read the message, then the encryption function is broken. Like they want to have a proof of that. You might say, well, why is that not straightforward? Well, let's look at an example, and we'll see some examples of sort of why, you know, these things that provide these very high security, you know, encryption and so on, often don't automatically lead to secure systems. So let's say we have a chat system, and we learned about digital signatures. Digital signatures let us verify who the message came from. Great. So what I'm going to do is we're going to have A and B communicate, and we're going to send a digital signature of in each message so that A knows it comes from B, and B knows it comes from A. And this means that no attacker is going to be able to, you know, forge a message. So I have this scenario here. A is, you know, asking B, oh, did you order lunch? Yeah, I did. A vegetarian? No, no, not this time, not in that mood. Oh, there's a guy at the door, should I let him in? And so we have this scenario here. You know, this guy at the door says here to prepare A, B, should I let him in? And an attacker can hijack this response. And despite the fact we're using signatures. So what can the attacker do here? Yeah, there. Yeah. The attacker can just copy this message here, which has a valid signature. And the signature scheme I chose is that I just, you know, we just took the message and passed it to the signature function. That's what it's for, right? And that signature is still going to be valid for that message. And so despite the fact we're using signatures, they haven't solved the problem we're really trying to solve. And the issue here is that the signature is telling us that at some point, A sent the message yes. That is not actually the information we want. We have this mismatch between what the signature verifies and what we care about. What we care about is that A sent the message yes in reply to this question. So how can we fix that? Well, we want to sign something that includes the context here. So we don't, the problem here is that we have this missing context in the message, and we can add some. So one way of doing this is what's called nonces, or numbers used only once. So a simple version of this scheme is that we just number all the messages from A and B. And we make sure what we're signing includes that number. Now, when the attacker wants to run this attack, they're going to copy this message, which has the wrong number. And assuming A actually checks the numbers, which maybe isn't a given, but we better do that, then the attacker's attack won't work. That they'll realize, this is an old message, I shouldn't display it, it's not correct. questions about this solution? Yeah.
Then for reply that's not really corresponding with any message, so then we just send the information, but you're not asking a question or reply to anything, would that just be a single signature of itself? Like, how do you determine that?
The question is, how do I determine, so, like, question is, I have these numbers to determine, like, if it's a reply to something else, what do I do if, like, it's not a question? My assumption is our chat clients in this scheme would always send the number because they're not trying to figure out what the messages mean. That would be the typical scheme we use for this. So that we just always send a number or something like a number. And we always increment it.
So you're assuming it's always replying to something?
The question I'm assuming always replying. So what the question is, what about the first message? Is your question? Yeah.
And so that makes sense why you have different signatures pairing together.
Yeah.
But what if A is just sending B a video, and then another video, and a third video, and then B is saying thank you? Like, how would you match the signatures?
Question, how would I match the signatures? The simplest scheme is that A always increments their number, and B always increments their number for every message, no matter what it is. So in the scenario of A sending B three videos, each video would be like number 7, number 8, number 9. And B's thank you response would just have the next number after the one that you sent previously.
Then how does it know which number is paired to which?
How does it know which number is paired to which? So I guess there's, so one option, so in the scheme I'm mentioning, we wouldn't actually know that B had received those past three messages, we just know that B sent this after its previous message. If we wanted to know that B had received its previous message, we could do a scheme where we let the other party choose the number to like explicitly verify that as a reply. So another scheme, which doesn't involve memorizing, is like that just A sends B a number to use next, and B sends A a number to use next. And then we know it's a reply, and that would get your property that you cared about, that you want to know it's actually a reply, not just sent after. And yeah, we can do it by having the other party choose the number to reply with. Yeah?
So the signature is a function of the number.
So the signature in the scheme, we're signing both the number and the message. So we're signing a message we compose from the actual useful to the human part of the message and this extra metadata. And that's going to be a common sort of pattern to fix these problems, is that we want to make sure we include the context of the message in what we're signing and or encrypting. Other questions? So we have this other solution where instead of just incrementing a counter, we have each party choose the next number to use, and we know it's tied to the previous message. And another thing with piece of context where we could have a problem with is, let's say B is communicating with M. Well, we have this signature here. The attacker could copy this message. So how do we prevent that? The simplest way is that we, you know, we'll change the signature to not be just underscore 50. We could have it like be M number 50, yes. And expect to include extra context in the message. But missing this type of context is a big way you can, if you use these tools naively, you can get in real trouble. So, and I showed this with sort of asymmetric encryption. You might say, well, if we use symmetric encryption, we wouldn't have this problem. With symmetric encryption, we have a similar problem with what's called reflection attacks, where we take a message from A to B and send it from B to A instead. Some questions about our replay attacks. So I guess I didn't say the name. So these are called replay attacks because the attack is we resend play again a message. And something I want to point out here is that, like, these attacks, like, don't depend on the math of the encryption stuff. And a thing I want to get across in this class is that the way most sort of things that use cryptography, encryption, and authentication, digital signatures, the way most of them break is not because someone has figured out how to break those encryption and authentication tools. Yes, you know, there are have been problems with some of them, and sometimes people choose make very poor choices, but the most common problems are these kinds of problems where it's not that there's some fancy math they're doing. It's sort of a more of an administrative slash bookkeeping oversight. And to give some real examples of that, some TLS implementations, I think, focused like on embedded devices, TLS being the protocol web browsers use to communicate with web servers securely, among other things, have this bug where the protocol has these two steps. So first, if you're talking to a web server, you verify you're talking to the right server. Step two is you start communicating with that server. And an attack a bunch of TLS implementations had was usually the server says, you know, here's my identity to do that first step, and then says, here's my next message after that step. You could just say, here's my next message, pretending we've just gotten to step two, and some clients were coded such that they said, oh, I got that message, we must be in step two, and just skip the verifying identity step. Oops. Or another example, Matrix is a chat program that tries to do message encryption, and they had this goal that each device a user uses would have its own public key and corresponding private key that would never leave the device. Great idea. So if I'm a user, my phone has one private key, my laptop has another private key, and those private keys never leave my laptop and never leave my phone. But we need some way to like send all my the corresponding public keys together. And the idea would be that I would use my phone to verify, yes, this is my laptop's key and vice versa. But it turned out that they forgot to check when getting these messages that they actually came from my phone or my laptop if you knew one to get the other. So you could just have a random machine say, yeah, this is really Charles's keys. And it would just not check. Oops. And I'm mentioning these kind of bugs because these are the sorts of things where you can use the correct encryption libraries and your software can still be broken. Like, as a practical advice, like, try to use tools that like solve your whole problem if possible. If not, you need to do some extra work, to make sure you're systematically avoiding these kinds of problems. And I'll mention the lab that's next week is going to be basically on replay attacks. What you're going to be doing in the lab is you're going to take the role of a network attacker where you get to forward messages however you like. And you can do things like forward a message that you saved earlier. So on, you're going to explore this. So going back to what I was talking about, promise to talk about later, was this bootstrapping keys problem. That, you know, we talked about how to do communication with these public keys, but I was so far assuming that I had somehow securely gotten the public keys of everyone I went to talk to. And that did not seem very practical. So we're gonna have a solution to make that kind of practical. And if we're thinking of the browsers talking to website scenario, well, getting the public key of a few websites, that's practical, but not all of them. So we're going to use this idea called a certificate. And the idea of certificates is that they're going to let us learn the public keys that someone else knows securely. So let's say A is a, let's say A is going to be our trusted. And let's say A knows B's public keys, and C doesn't. But C trusts A, and C wants to use A's knowledge of B's public key to get B's public key itself. So one thing we could have do is we could have C like securely talk to A, but you know that's not so practical. We don't want to have to rely on A being around. So we'll have A do some work in advance, and A will generate what we'll call a certificate for B. So A will say, hey, I know B's public key. B's public key is this, and we want to verify that A knew that and not someone else. So we'll have a digital signature of that message that B's public key is this. And we'll call this thing a certificate, and A can just give that certificate to B. Then when C wants to talk to B, C doesn't ask A for B's public key. Instead, B just sends this thing that A prepared earlier to B, and C verifies, yep, that's from A. I trust A, therefore I now know B's public key. Let's talk shocking to B. So this is the idea of a certificate, that we have a message that tells us someone else's public key that's signed using the private key of someone who we know the public key of already and we trust. So this is going to allow us to bootstrap knowing more public keys from a small number of public keys. Yes?
So would A generate a certificate for B and then send that certificate to B and send to C then?
Question, would A generate the certificate for B and then send it to B for B to send to C? Yes. That would be the typical way this would work. Other questions? So this is the scheme that sort of the web uses for getting public keys to browsers. That websites and some other parties go to A, various A's, which we call certificate authorities. With their public key, the certificate authority signed these messages saying, yes, the key for foo.com is X. They get that certificate, and the certificates are sent to the browsers. And the browsers don't contact the certificate authority themselves, they just verify the message actually came from a certificate authority that they somehow already knew about. And we'll talk about how do they know about those in a bit. And you can like look at certificates. So here, this is a dump of the information in a certificate for canvas.its.virginia.edu. It's actually in a binary format. I have just ran a tool here that dumps that in a plain text format. And it turns out it produces a ton of output, which is why I have some dot, dot, dots here. And also, it continues on the next slide. So you can see that this signed message says, oh, this is this certificate authority, some organization called the In Common RSA Server Certificate Authority, verifying within these dates that canvas.its.virginia.edu, which has the DNS name canvas.its.virginia.edu, really has the public key here, and there's a digital signature, so we can verify that really this certificate authority signed it. And this is the information that's sent to the web browser. So the web browser is going to check this signature here, which is going to be on this all the data beforehand. So it's going to take all the data beforehand, and the signature, pass it to the verify function, check that, yes, it's really the signature from this in common RSA server CA people, and then it knows, oh, it says canvas.its.virginia.edu is public key, is this, therefore now I know how to communicate with canvas.its.virginia.edu. So questions?
Yes.
So question here is, you might say, well, who is this in common RSA server CA people, and how does the browser get their keys? And the simplest answer would be, well, we'd have the public key for the in common server RSA certificate authority ship with the browser or the OS. And well, we turns out we have some certificate authority key ship with the browser or the OS, but not that one. But as you might say, but Canvas works, so clearly something's happening. And the answer is that, well, that certificate authority is going to have their own certificate that's assigned by a certificate authority that we do have shipped with our browser. So that certificate authority, you know, the browser doesn't know its public key, but it's going to learn it through another certificate that's signed by the User Trust RSA certification authority according to the certificate. If you look at these certificates, it turns out all those names are wrong because these certificates are like 10 years old, and these are all operated by a different company now, but the names haven't changed because they have to stay the same, basically. And so we have a chain of certificates. So we have this User Trust RSA certification authority that's shipped with my browser, and there's a certificate signed by that core private key for this in common server RSA that signs a certificate for Colab and Canvas, and that's how my browser verifies it. So my browser gets the certificate for Colab and Canvas and this certificate, and it already has the public key for some of these what we call trust anchor certificate authorities that it already knows about when you download the browser. So it uses the ones it downloaded to verify one certificate that gets you to another, lets it verify another certificate until we get to the website you actually care about. Yes?
So in this case, the top hierarchy
decides to delete your database and the whole internet shutdown? Question, if the top hierarchy company decides to delete their database to hold it and internet shutdown? So there are multiple top hierarchy companies. So here I've highlighted three of like 60, 70 trust anchors that are distributed with most browsers. So we have one, this thing called the User Trust RSA Certification Authority that's actually run by the UK company Satigo. There's another here, the Global Sign Root CA, that's run by the GMO Internet Group, which I think is, I don't know where they're based offhand. I would guess somewhere in Europe. And we have this other one that is run by Google. So there's a whole bunch of these, so we don't depend on any one company in particular for the most part.
So they're all providing the same service?
Question, so they're all providing the same service? Yes, and the websites get to choose which one they get a certificate from. Yeah?
What if like the private key from one of the top certificate authorities was leaked?
What if the private key from one of the top certificate authorities was leaked? Would that mean you could forge websites? Yes. So if that sort of thing happens, people update their browsers to not trust that certificate authority anymore. Also, this is related to why, you might wonder, why does Satigo operate two different certificate authorities instead of just signing things directly from the main one? And the primary reason for that is that they keep the private key for this certificate authority offline. So to sign things with that private key, they like need to have people go into a secure room. And that's so that it doesn't get compromised. So if the private key for this certificate authority does get compromised, they can just make a new one with the non-compromised private key.
Your gut,
it's supposed to be, yes. Other questions? Yeah.
How do those companies make money?
So historically, certificates used to cost money, and that was their primary source of revenue. This is perhaps a little more complicated if you know how certificates work today, because there are a couple free certificate providers, the most notable of which is Let's Encrypt, which is run by a nonprofit. So how will they continue making money in the future is a complicated question. If people care about so-called extended validation, so if you've seen, like, you go to a website and, like, there's the company name in the corner, that's extended validation. That's usually still cost money. That might be way otherwise. It's not a resolved question. Other questions? Okay, so we have a bunch of these trust anchors, and I mentioned there's multiple of them. So I checked this last year and haven't updated this since, but presumably the numbers have changed by a couple. But Firefox had, as of last year, 155 of these, 155 root certificate authorities operated by 55 distinct entities. And Windows had 237 operated by 86 distinct entities. So there's, turns out there's a lot of these certificate authorities. And we have these certificate authorities where we have these chains of certificates. The kind of name for all this put together is a public key infrastructure. You'll sometimes see this abbreviated PKI. And the most prominent PKI is the one that you see with browsers used for verifying the identity of websites. There are, in fact, multiple of these, usually with different certificate authorities and maybe different ways certificates work. So, for example, there's a separate one intended for verifying domain name records. There's a separate one used by companies like Apple for verifying code in the App Store. So there's multiple of these, but the same idea, we use these certificates from these certificate authorities to sort of verify something without directly contacting those certificate authorities. We get these certificates that let us check ourselves from some trust anchor, some small set of trusted entities. Okay, and I guess in my remaining minute, I'll talk about, so I talked about these certificate authorities that you get a certificate from. You might wonder, how did they verify that canvas.its.virginia.edu really was that? And the answer is not great. The rules that browsers specify, you know, basically, these are the most common ways are you send an email to the domain contact, you look it up and from the domain register, send an email and make sure that they receive a value, or you check that it works on the website for you. If you could say, this doesn't seem like it solves the problem, sure, that is how it works. There's some extra things they do that make it not as bad, but if you were imagining that they're gonna precisely verify each thing, that's not how it works in practice, and that's also why it's cheap to have a website, though, so. Yeah.
What's BR?
What's BR? The baseline requirements, sorry. Which is what the browsers have told the people who run the certificate authorities for the web that they have to do, or else the browsers will not include them. So in order to be included by Firefox or Windows, you have to follow these rules, or at least appear to follow these rules, and those rules let specify these ways are acceptable for verifying websites. And that's where I'll finish up, since I'm out of time today, we'll on this next time.